From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Lawrence Ferlinghetti was born in 1919, and he died just short of turning 102 years old. I had the privilege of talking to him on the radio in 2012. He was in his 90s already. He drove to the radio station. He came by himself. He was a direct, fascinating, informed speaker. I don't know any other 93-year-olds, which was when I met him, who were as impressive. Lawrence Ferlinghetti was still a writer, still a bookstore owner, still a poet, and a wonderful person. This show is dedicated to him, and we are doing this show with a woman named Maya Ip, who began earlier in her life as a personal assistant to Ferlinghetti. She worked at the City Lights bookstore, which Ferlinghetti began in 1953. She worked there with him from 2006 to 2013. Maya Ip, what was it like to meet Ferlinghetti? How old was he when you met him?
When I first met Lawrence, he was already in his 80s. But as you described, Michael, he was 100% independent, sharp, critical, funny, and he was soft-spoken. You know, he was modest. But when you got to know him, when I had the chance to get to know him, he was incredibly kind, always keeping up with what was new and interesting in the world and wanting to talk about it. And it was a great privilege that I got to spend the years that I did working with him.
Yes, I found him that way too. I was there at KQED in San Francisco. Lawrence was there, a very great Hungarian writer named László Krasznahorkai was with us, as was Krasznahorkai's wife. With me was my friend from poetry and fiction here in Los Angeles, Jim Crusoe, who was teaching writing at that time at Santa Monica College, and whose favorite writer was Krasznahorkai. We had such a good time during the interview that László and I, Jim Crusoe, László's wife, eagerly accepted the invitation to go to lunch at an Italian restaurant across the street from City Lights with Lawrence. He was treated like visiting royalty. They kept bringing more dishes, different glasses of wine. They were obviously honored to have him there, and we had a great time. It was as if the 60s had come back and I was at a table with people who had things to say, ideas about what each other had to say, conversation that didn't end for hours and hours and hours. It was delightful. Now, he was your boss, Maya Ip, who worked at City Lights. Was he delightful as a boss, too?
You know, he absolutely was delightful. He often had sharp insights about things like new translations that were being published from French. We often spoke about that. But he, you know, he really, really cared about the people he worked with, and he cared about the people who sent him mail or sent him manuscripts. It really mattered to him that people felt that he had taken them seriously and that he appreciated the way that they responded to his work, that it meant so much to them. That was really clear.
His native language was French. He spoke French before he spoke English.
Right.
And he eventually came to translate French poetry. He later in his life became a serious painter. He also traveled to Italy to find his father's birthplace. He was, as he said about Ezra Pound, a man of international sensibilities, but also a man of American sensibilities. And that was the excitement of much of the work he did late in his life, he was writing what he considered to be an American epic. Did he ever talk to you about that, Maya?
We did, yeah. I was, while I was working there, he was definitely working on some of those later works. And, you know, I think it's interesting how you say that he was an American poet and an international poet. And I think that for him, he represented, at least to those of us who are young enough on staff, a kind of different type of American that could encompass that kind of international spirit. That the writing he was doing, for him, that wasn't in conflict. It was part of being the kind of American writer he was.
Yes, thank you. That's Maya Ip, who served for some 7 years as the personal assistant to Lawrence Ferlinghetti. As you all listen to this show, which is being re-aired for the first time since 2012, listen to how Lawrence Ferlinghetti is in mourning for the passing of a culture, even then, that was already important to him, and important even more so now. This is an interview with the magnificent Lawrence Ferlinghetti from 2012, and it's our honor to be able to pay tribute to him in this way on Bookworm.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. When I discovered that Lawrence Ferlinghetti, my guest today, has a new book at the age of 93, I couldn't wait to read it. He's been assembling his work into an epic of American consciousness. He has returned to the great questions of the American voice. What is an American? What is the American mood? And in order to do so, he's modeled the new book on, well, William Carlos Williams's Patterson, on Charles Olson's Maximus, on Allen Ginsberg's Fall of America, and Ed Sanders' America, A History in Verse.
You notice that Ezra Pound is left out of that list. The Cantos is not on that list because that's not an American consciousness.
It's global consciousness, yes?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. And what I love about this book, which is called Time of Useful Consciousness, is that for me, it bridges the gap between Walt Whitman and the Beats. You've always said that you were not really a member of the Beat Generation.
Well, I think that Allen Ginsberg bridged the gap between Walt Whitman and the Beats.
Well, definitely. But you're using those people who make an American pageant, an American panorama, including Carl Sandburg, Vachel Lindsay, the poets that have been often forgotten today, but they were the American troubadour poets. They traveled, they read, their voices were crucial.
Well, my first volume in this series, it might be called, was called Americus. And the new book, Time of Useful Consciousness, is really the second volume of Americus. It continues, as you said, it echoes many poets over the centuries, American poets. A fragmented recording of the American stream of consciousness rather than just the American consciousness. So, of course, that means you can put anybody in there that was American and hear their voices echoing in the air. No matter when they said it, it's still in the air somewhere.
Well, it's profound, too, because you say stream of consciousness, but the river of consciousness, the Mississippi River, is crucial to this book because we have Mark Twain and going up and down the Mississippi, seeing it as a kind of spinal cord. connecting the North and the South, and so much of the book is understanding American geography as creating the American spirit.
The fact is, I actually took a trip on the Mississippi for this book, starting up near Minneapolis, and I went on a raft all the way down to south of Natchez, where you couldn't go any further in a small craft. I had a rented houseboat, and I would often be wedged between two huge barges going through these locks. And I'm on this little tiny houseboat, which is like a raft when you compared to these monstrous barges full of coal, dirty coal from the upper states.
Well, I also love your celebration of the literary magazines, too. You mention Big Table in the poem and the feel of Paul Carroll, the big man carrying Big Table to publishing houses and to bookstores.
To Barber's bookstore.
Yeah. And I remember that magazine as well. I've got issues of it on my shelf. It was always the place where the newest and best was appearing. Was your work rejected a lot because of the grouping with the Beats?
No. Quite often it was published because I was associated with the Beats, but as I've often said, I was from an earlier generation. I was from the Bohemian generation. When I arrived in San Francisco in 1951, direct from University of Paris, where I'd been on the GI Bill, I was still wearing my French beret. And this is 1951, and there were Bohemians. That's what they call people who led unconventional lives before the Beats. And then when the Beats arrived, that became the name for the same. But so I was really an earlier generation. I became associated with the Beats by publishing them.
It's kind of amazing when you're reading Time of Useful Consciousness to see how specific the locations in America. You go to St. Louis in the book. You really try and do a kind of counter Henry James. Henry James wrote a book called The American Scene. This is like the scene of the people. Henry James is always looking at the glass butterflies at the Harvard Library.
Yeah.
But you're, you know, kind of out where the plains meet.
Well, his geography was the geography of the Boston Brahmin, wasn't it?
Exactly. And what would you call your geography?
I guess a rootless geography, because I didn't feel I belonged in any one place. I grew up in New York, but I lived in France when I was a very small boy and spoke French before English. I discovered my father's roots just the last 10 years, Italian, born in Brescia, northern Italy. And my mother was Sephardic Portuguese. Her family name was Mendes Monsanto, and they came from Portugal during the Spanish Inquisition to St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands. My mother was born in Providence, Rhode Island. I went to find my father's birthplace in northern Italy. I found the birthplace just about 10 years ago, and I went there, and I have a gallerista in Verona, and he sent a cameraman with me because he wanted to record this. And we went and found the address in Brescia, this in the working class district. And there was an apartment house there now, not a single family house. And we rang all the bells, nobody came. Finally, an old guy, looks like the janitor, came out, and he was wheeling a broken radiator. And he saw us, and I think he was an old communist, and he looked at us, and I think he thought we were artists of some kind. He started screaming at us, "Parasiti, parasiti, parasiti," and he called the police. My cameraman would film the whole thing, and then he immediately sent it to all the newspapers. It came out in all the papers, "Poet in search of his father, arrestato." And
that'll teach you to go looking for your roots. Yeah,
exactly.
I'm talking to Lawrence Ferlinghetti about his book, Time of Useful Consciousness. It's an epic, and it's volume two of Americus. At the age of 93, we'll continue after this short break.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Earn your graduate degree in a flexible online format from University of Southern California and learn from faculty at the top of their fields in areas such as business, health, law, engineering, psychology, communications, and more. Explore your options today at online.usc.edu.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm. I'm talking with Lawrence Ferlinghetti about Time of Useful Consciousness. Ferlinghetti's poem is an epic pageant and a fragmented recording of the American stream of consciousness, including fellow poets William Carlos Williams, Vachel Lindsay, Charles Olson, Carl Sandburg, and Allen Ginsberg. Tell me, what does Time of Useful Consciousness mean?
Oh, it's an aeronautical term, meaning the time between when you're deprived of oxygen and when you pass out. And in that short period, you have an opportunity to do something to save yourself, which I see as the world situation today. Today is what you call willful ignorance of what's happening ecologically in the world.
Do you think that there still is a chance to reverse what has been happening?
Not as long as the powers that be remain in power and the oil companies and the energy companies and the coal companies control the world situation.
When I was reading Time of Useful Consciousness, there's a point where you talk about the web's tendency to ingest everything. And then you decide that rather than speak of that, that you will take on the Whitmanic job of celebration and become huge and inclusive again. It's almost as if you decide that you will counter the internet. And I thought to myself, gee, when is the last time I read a poem that ends so joyfully? Is it still possible to feel joy, or is it a way of saying, what other choice do we have?
Yes, well, I felt that I was getting toward the end of the story and that it was, had become such a funeral dirge that I couldn't stand it anymore. And actually, I break off in the middle of one of the sections and there's an asterisk on the page, and then the next words are, enough, enough, enough already. I almost added the already, but I didn't know how many Jewish readers were out there. So it was enough, and so then I turned to the lyric escape. In the face of all this foreboding about the end of the world, there's always the lyric escape, which you could say is another form of willful ignorance.
That's what I was wondering. Are you opting for the escape?
Yes, well, because I couldn't stand to go any further on the burial of humanity and the burial of our civilization and et cetera. I turned to Walt Whitman as a great yay-sayer. And the last line is great yay-sayer, father poet, where now?
Now, I wanted to ask you, around maybe a third of the way into the epic, you point out that there are no more fireflies in Italy.
Yes, so this is what Pier Paolo Pasolini said way back when, before he died, and he said, the disappearance of fireflies in Italy heralds the start of a terrible era.
And by the end, the question is, are there still fireflies in America? And so I wondered, the organization of this epic, for all of its apparent looseness, stream of consciousness, fragmentedness, is in fact, it seems to me, very tight. Yes?
Very tight?
Very tight, that it's well organized. The poem seems to me to be enormously well felt, if not, you know, well thought out, completely coherent and arranged as a comment on American destiny.
Yes, well, as an editor, I did work toward making it very tight, and there are large sections that I cut out, parts that, I mean, maybe I would have 10 or 20 more pages, at least, of material that I didn't use, including, you may notice that there's no footnotes in this volume, whereas in America's One, there were regular footnotes. This one, I decided to steal without credit. But I had some correspondence with my publisher, New Directions, about this, and I said, well, if your lawyers don't object, I think everything will get passed as fair use, quote, fair use, unquote. In other words, I didn't steal whole pages from anybody, but I stole, as the first lines of America stated, it was to summarize the past by theft and illusion, not illusion, but allusion.
And after all, isn't this Eliot's method in The Wasteland as well?
Oh, yeah. It's totally summarizing the past by theft and illusion. And, of course, Ezra Pound did the same thing.
Of course. At that time, the network of elusiveness proved that there was a past that could be referred to by a poet, and that any American would know the past.
Yeah. But today?
But today, what do you think? What are we going to do?
Well, I think the whole classical culture, I mean, the canon, as it's called, and the Greco-European culture in general is going down the drain faster than anybody realizes. It's kind of the electronic revolution. It's just disappearing. The whole old culture is just disappearing. So you have people under 25 years old who wouldn't know, recognize a single reference in one of my books. Never even heard of T.S. Eliot, probably, much less Allen Ginsberg.
You run now the bookstore City Lights, along with many others. It's one of the, what would you call it, bookstore by appointment in America. You go there because you want to see the bookstore where so many literary events took place. It has a magnificent poetry section. It keeps the volumes of American essays. People coming to San Francisco inevitably go to City Lights. You have attained the status of poetic hero to the younger generation. So I wanted to ask you, does one become a poet, or is one born a poet?
I think you just become one against your will. I mean, any sane person wouldn't choose it as a vocation. Instead of being entranced by poetry and books when I arrived in San Francisco, I should have gone up to the Napa Valley and started a vineyard.
Now, would you say the feeling in Time of Useful Consciousness is that the history of poetry is cognate with the history of America, that what we do is to read poetry to know who we are.
Well, that's a nice utopian idea, very dreamy, but I don't necessarily think it's true.
I wish it were.
Yeah.
Right now, if I talk to a young poet, except for a very few young poets, no one will talk about E. E. Cummings anymore. No one will talk about Patchen anymore.
E. who?
Yeah. Well, but you know, they'll even people who have heard of Eliot and who would love E. Cummings, they don't read him. They've been told he's, you know, foolish or silly, whereas, you know, he's one of the great joys.
I mean, I remember a poem of Cummings. Spring is a perhaps hand arranging and changing things in a window.
It's beautiful.
And the topography was all over the page. It was like as if they were, it was a window.
And here in Time of Useful Consciousness, you have a beautiful section celebrating the American immigrant. As if the world were still open to the immigrant. This is a very rescuing book. It's giving life, giving blood back to ideas that have often, alas, been dropped along the way. I mean, how strange, funny, brilliant that Ferlinghetti is reviving the belief in the future of the country through the course of its immigration. How beautiful.
Well, that's a great compliment. I mean, especially today when we have so many people who are really saying, don't give me your tired and your impoverished hordes from all over the world. There's been this adulteration of the American dream in the last 60 or 70 years, it seems to me, of the last 50 years.
I've been talking with Lawrence Ferlinghetti about his book of poems, Time of Useful Consciousness, published by New Directions. It's the second volume of his epic, Americus One. It's a beautiful book, and thank you.
Oh, thank you, Michael.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Today's program was recorded at KQED in San Francisco. Special thanks to engineer Howard Gelman at KQED. Thanks to Krager Thine. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
She's a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.